So the way we want to kind of go through the events leading up to at Stonewall and post Stonewall is to pick up on three key threads that I want you to kind of try to keep in mind if you can as we go through some of the narrative of the stories. The first of those threads is around this question of what's changed and what stayed the same. So you'll notice, obviously, that a huge thing changes as a result of the Stonewall uprising. But you will also notice that a lot of the homophobia and transphobia that we talk about in the build-up and during and after remains the same. So that theme of how things have changed and how things stay the same is important. The second thing that we want to highlight is the fact that activism and what individual activists and what political things you argue makes a difference in the course of history. And it can feel like, you know, printing out leaflets, making proposals, being in meetings can sometimes be a bit tedious, but I think some of the things around before and after Stonewall give us an indication of just why what we do and what people in this room do is so important. The third theme is based on, sort of sparks off the first, which is the fact that because things change, stay the same so much, we want to argue that you need to overthrow the entire system of capitalism. You might hear that a few times in this conference. In order to actually live in a liberated society. So that's the third thing to look out for. So if we go back then to the context in the lead up to Stonewall, and I think this is really important, and sometimes if you just jump straight into Stonewall, you don't quite get the significance of it. So thinking about what it was like in the 1950s and in the 60s leading up to Stonewall, I think really makes it even more of an amazing series of events. During the Second World War, there was a sort of opening up in society in some ways, and particularly actually for lesbians and gay men and people of diverse sexualities, in that for women there was a sort of increased level of independence around being able to work within the war movement, that women were more able to kind of live on their own or have reasons to sort of be individual rather than married because men had disappeared off to war. Men in the military, in relationships with each other, were sort of overlooked, and it was kind of like, well, while the war is on, we all need to just focus on that and, like, let's not worry about persecuting homosexuals at this point. So there was a sense after the war then that maybe this would continue, but actually the 1950s saw a real sort of moral crackdown. In the military itself, there was a kind of witch hunt or a homosexual hunt to kind of ferret out, as one lesbian tells the story. She, a woman called Joni Phelps, was a lesbian, sort of middle-ranking officer in the army, and she was asked by her commander, who was General Dwight D. Eisenhower, if she would help him by drawing up a list of known lesbians in her battalion. And the way she responded to this, in the room, looking him in the face, this is her recalling the story, she says, "Yeah, I will draw up a list for you if you're prepared to lose every single driver, every single file clerk, every single commander, and if my name is going to be at the top of that list." And Eisenhower apparently said, "Okay, don't worry about it." But this was the kind of atmosphere, and also the resistance, in the House of Un-American Activities Committee, where they wanted to basically purge the civil service, the public service in America, of homosexuals. People were often approached and asked to give a list of 10 names, and if you could give a list of 10 names of homosexuals in the public service, you, as also a known homosexual, would kind of be spared from being sacked. And some people went along with that, and some people said no, and they lost their jobs. So there was a real lot of decisions being made by people in this process. And at one point in the 1950s, it's reported that 1,000 people a month were being arrested, were being questioned about being homosexual and so on. So this crackdown and this idea of un-American behaviour, which is very, again, continuity, was a very big part of people's lives in that period.
Yeah, and so you had both Republicans and Democrats in New York trying to, like, beat each other as to who could be the most morally righteous and up the ante on being draconian, using the public morals officers of the police that they set up. And, yeah, it was said of the 50s and 60s that the homosexual was smothered by law. And by the end of the the decade, the 50s, the US government had put together homophobic and transphobic laws unmatched by anywhere else in the Western world. And these laws meant that in 7 states, men found to have had consensual sex in their own homes faced legal castration. In California and Pennsylvania, you could be put into mental institutions for life. New York, you could be actually arrested for not wearing 3 items of clothing appropriate to your sex. And this, again, was enforced by the public morals officers. The medical establishment was also a key site of discrimination. Homosexuality was considered a psychopathic personality disorder, and treatments for the disorder included repeated shock therapy and chemical castration. Another side to things is the role the media played in bolstering LGBTI oppression via publishing lists of names of those arrested for being gay or trans, as well as establishing and reinforcing some of the worst homophobic and transphobic stereotypes. So it was safe to say that life for the gender and sexually diverse in New York pre-Stonewall was very dangerous. Violence, blackmail, murder characterised your existence as a gay or trans person.
Yeah. And in that context, like the early resistance in the 1950s and the people who set up the first homophile organisations, people like Harry Hay, who was a member of the Communist Party in New York, set up the Mattachine Society in 1950 as a way of at least connecting himself with other gay men. In 1952, they became known and attracted membership because they fought against, or they appealed basically, or took to court a case in which the police had entrapped a gay man. This is extremely, extremely common police tactics at this time. Entrapment was then, continues to be, illegal. Like, the police are not obviously allowed to do this, but they just did it kind of with impunity. And so Harry Hay and the Mattachine Society decided with one of these cases to challenge it and say this was an entrapment and it was illegal, and they actually won the case in 1952. And as a result, a lot of gay men sort of thought, oh, okay, they're doing something, we want to maybe be a part of it. For lesbians, in 1956, the Daughters of Bilitis, as pronounced in New York, Daughters of Bilitis, sometimes people say Bilitis here, no, I don't know. Anyway, they had these sort of very undergroundy names. Mattachine is like some medieval musicians who wore masks who were sort of thought to be gay. And Bilitis, I
think. Mischievous.
Mischievous. There you go. that works. So their thing was sort of getting lesbians together, having social events, at least just finding other people who felt similar. And their kind of approach to politics was very well referenced by the name of their publication, The Ladder, this sort of step-by-step kind of approach to change. And so they put out a publication and they were emphasising education of the variant, you know, being very softly kind of trying to get people to understand their existence, basically.
Yeah, and there was much debate within these early gay rights groups, including the Mattachine Society, about how and what they should be doing to advance the lot of gay people. And initially they held pickets at the White House and other government buildings that started in 1965 and were organised to challenge the federal government's exclusion of gay people from government jobs. And one of the key arguments they raised was gay people want to serve their country too. And these protests continued every 4th of July on American Independence Day, which I think it's right to point out the hypocrisy of the supposed land of the free, but you get a sense of how limited the movement was and the questions they were raising. The Mattachines helped build a campaign to protest the exclusion of gay people from the military, where they called nationwide days of action. And in that same year, 1966, that those were first called, they organised a sit-in and won rights for gay people to gather in public and establish that bars were not legally entitled to bar gay people from entering. And these sit-ins were directly inspired by the civil disobedience of the civil rights movement. And so you can see, like, this campaign for homosexual rights at the time was being established, but the horizons were kept low, and generally heads were kept down, because for many of those people involved, they themselves could not envision a society where gender and sexuality was embraced. And yeah, nor could they envision the fight that would be necessary to see that society won. This is one of the protests outside.
And apparently, the lesbians involved with it started to get really pissed off because they were like, "Why do we have to dress in these stupid, like, formal, feminine clothes? Like, this is, we'd never wear something like this." But then, when they go and do these pickets, it's like part of that whole like respect us kind of respectable thing.
And this is one of the sip-ins in 1966. But yeah.
And the funny story about that, sorry, just I'm ad-libbing slightly, that the first couple of bars they went in, because they really wanted to be refused service, so they would go in and they would go, "We're gay and we want to have a drink." And the bar was like, "Sure, what do you want?" They're like, no, you're supposed to kick us out. And they're like, "No, it was fine." They're like, "Oh, come on, let's go to the next place." I think it was the third bar they went to. They were like, "Finally, someone's refused to serve us. Right, let's do it." That's activism for you. You never know.
But the reality of such severe repression mixed with the growing radicalism of the 60s meant that there were also the rumblings of a more angry and demanding movement, with small but sometimes violent protests that took place against police harassment. So one of the most famous is the Compton's cafeteria riots in San Francisco in 1966, and it's kind of known as the dress rehearsal for the Stonewall riots, where, you know, police car windows were smashed and fires were set. But what happened after that was not a movement like Stonewall. Those involved were generally, like, disregarded from the mainstream gay movement. Yeah, so, like, to sum that up, there's basically all these many debates about how forthright to be, what to demand, what tactics to use, and this did not just apply to the gay rights movement. This applied to all of the different movements that were sweeping America at the time.
Yeah, and I think one of the kind of rewritings or the way that history is presented is often like one thing in isolation. So you think about Stonewall and you think about gay liberation as this process sort of happening almost in a vacuum. But, of course, during the 1960s, like, the black civil rights movement was probably the major inspiration for Stonewall and the people who organised after Stonewall. The anti-Vietnam War movement was, you know, building and building. The police were attacking it. They had to go through some of the same debates in those movements. And Frank Kameny, who is one of the sort of... He's this interesting figure in gay liberation history because he goes from radical to conservative to sort of back again. He's now sort of fits in the, like, good gay liberation people. But at the time, he was pretty radical. And he argued, and this is a quote, "I do not see the NAACP or CORE," so two of the black civil rights groups, "worrying about which gene or chromosome produced a black skin or the possibility of bleaching the Negro." So he's basically saying, you know, the black liberation campaign, they adopted the slogan "Black is beautiful." Mm. Before, he then said, we should say gay is good. Like, let's have that positive thing. Let's not make it about how we can change ourselves, how we can be treated, you know, for our illness or whatever. Like, let's embrace the fact that this is who we are and it's good to be positive about it. So this is these are things happening in the 1960s. Like, we're still having this... That's partly what Safe Schools was about, being able to say being gay is good. Oh, no, you can't say that. You know, so that same debate was happening all through the 1960s and onwards.
Yeah, and this for the Stonewall riots themselves, it was the first taste of actually living out this gay is good and asserting that. A flyer handed out by activists in the wake of the riot said, "Do you think homosexuals are revolting? You bet your sweet ass we are." And Craig Rodwell, who was one of the participants, he described it as there was this very volatile, active political feeling, especially among young people. When the night of the Stonewall riots came along, just everything came together. And at that one moment, people often ask what was so special, but there was no one thing special about it. It was just everything coming together. One of those moments in history that if you were there, you knew this is it. This is what we've been waiting for. And Thomas Lane Schmidt, another participant, wrote a piece called Mother Stonewall and the Golden Rats, and it gives a really nice picture of just why this riot mattered and who were the kinds of people involved.
This is kind of a long quote, but I think it's a really beautiful depiction of just why the Stonewall Inn in particular was this site of resistance. "We sat on the curb gutter around the corner from a dance bar called the Stonewall. He had wounds suited up and down his arms. The army had rejected him for being a queer. His father had thrown him out of the house through a glass door. I'd left home for the last time too. I was supposed to be on a ditch digging road repair summer job crew with a bunch of jerks I'd gone to school with. They would have buried me alive just for the fun of it. So I up and went to New York City with just the clothes on my back. One queen had an enormous burn scar covering her face and most of her body. Her mother didn't want men to be tempted by her son's beauty. We lived in cheap hotels, broken down apartments, abandoned buildings or on the streets. Home was where the heart is. Some were able to get menial jobs, some were on welfare, some of us hustled, many of us panhandled. Food was where you found it. Many of us had gotten thrown out of home before finishing high school. We were street rats. Puerto Rican, black, northern and southern whites, Debbie the Dyke and a Chinese queen named Jade East, the sons and daughters of postal workers, welfare mothers, cab drivers, mechanics and nurses' aides. We ended up together at a place called the Stonewall, safe and sound. All you had to do was find an empty beer can so the waiter would think you bought a drink and the night was yours. A replica of a wishing well stood near the back bar of one of the two large black-painted rooms. The jukebox played a lot of Motown music. We danced. The air conditioners seemed not to work at all because the place was always so crowded. We were happy. This place was the art that gave form to the feelings of our heartbeats. Here, the consciousness of knowing you belonged nestled into that warm feeling of finally being home. And home engenders love and loyalty quite naturally. So we loved the Stonewall."
That's so nice. So, yeah, you had the largest gay ghetto in the village, you had the nation's largest gay club in the village, and you had... it was a bar that was too for people too young, too poor, or too much for anywhere else. And you had the most severe police repression in the history of the country to that point, and therefore you had the setting of what was about to come. And so, like I mentioned before, bars on raids like this were not uncommon. The New York State Liquor Authority had the power to revoke the license of owners who permit their premises to become disorderly, and they deliberately declined to define disorderly. So pretty much every gay bar, just like Stonewall, was run by the mafia, who paid off police to keep the place from being shut down entirely, but keep it open so they could continue to cash in on one of the most marginalised communities in the city. So, having raided Stonewall on Tuesday of the same week, the hated police inspector, Seymour Pine, gave the order to move in at 1:20 a.m. Saturday morning on June 28th, 1969. And he was convinced that his meticulously planned operation would make a lasting statement. He was fed up with... he'd, like, raided this place so many times before. He'd raided all the gay bars so many times before, yet the mafia would open them back up the next day, and it was just a kind of routine for show. And he wanted to actually do the job properly this time. He planned to rip out Stonewall's long wooden bar and cut it into pieces to send a lasting message to the gay community that you don't belong anywhere. But what followed was a very unprecedented response from the LGBTR community to what they thought was just a routine raid. So have a bit of an interactive...
Friday evening, June 27th, 1969, at about 11:45, eight officers from New York City's Public Morals Squad loaded into four unmarked police cars and headed to the Stonewall Inn here at 7th Avenue and Christopher Street. The local precinct had just received a new commanding officer, who kicked off his tenure by initiating a series of raids on gay bars. The Stonewall was an inviting target, operated by the Gambino crime family without a liquor license. The dance bar drew a crowd of drag queens, hustlers, and minors. A number of the bar's patrons had spent the early part of the day outside the Frank Campbell funeral home, where Judy Garland's funeral was held. She had died the Sunday before. It was almost precisely at midnight that the Morals Squad pulled up to the Stonewall Inn, led by Deputy Inspector Seymour Pine.
There was never any reason to feel that anything of any unusual situation would occur that night.
He could actually feel it in the air. He really could. I guess Judy Garland's death just really helped us really hit fan.
For some reason, things were different this night. As we were bringing the prisoners out, they were resisting.
people started gathering in front of this Sherman Square Park right across the street from Stonewall. People were upset. No, we're not going to go. And people started screaming and hollering.
One drag queen, as we put her in the car, opened the door on the other side and jumped out. We had to chase that person, and he was caught, put back into the car. He made another attempt to get out the same door, the other door, and at that point we had to handcuff the person. From this point on, things really began to get crazy.
My name is Robert Barron, and my nickname is Dirty, and I've been cross-dressing all of my life. I remember the night of the riots. The police were escorting the queens out of the bar and into the paddy wagon. And there was this one particularly outrageously beautiful queen, stacks and stacks of Elizabeth style, Elizabeth Taylor style hair. And she was asking them not to push her. And they continued to push her, and she turned around and she gnashed the cop with her high heel. And then she proceeded to frisk him for her, the keys to the handcuffs that were on her. And she undid herself and passed them to another queen that was behind her.
And then we had to get back into Stonewall.
My name is Martin Boyce. In 1969, I was a drag queen known as Miss Mia. I remember on that night, what we sort of like these oldest drag queens with long blondes, with rockettes, sang the song we used to sing. We are the village girls. We wear our hair in curls. We wear our dungarees above our nellies. And the police went crazy hearing that, and they just immediately rushed us. We gave one kick and fled.
My name is Ruby, and the night of the Stonewall, I was 18. And to tell you the truth, that night I was doing more running than fighting. I remember looking back from 10th Street. And there on Waverly Street, there was a police, I believe, on his helicopter, and was on his stomach in his tactical uniform and his helmet and everything else, with a drag queen straddling him. She was beating the hell out of him with her shoe. Whether it was a high heel or not, I don't know. But she was beating the hell out of him. It was hysterical. Yes.
My name is Martha Jean. I'm a lesbian. I remember on that night, I was in a gay bar, a women's bar, called Cookies. We were coming out of the gay bar, going toward 8th Street. And that's when we saw everything happen, blasting away, people getting beat up, police coming from every direction, hitting women as well as men with their nightsticks, gay men running down the street with blood all over their face. We decided right then and there whether we scared or not. We didn't think about it. We just jumped in.
Here, this queen is going completely bananas, you know, jumping and hitting the windshield. The next thing you know, a taxi cab was being turned over, other cars were being turned over, things. Windows were shattering all over the place, fires were burning around the place. It was beautiful, it really was. It was really beautiful.
I remember one cop coming at me, hitting me with the nightstick in the back of my legs. I broke loose and I went after him. I grabbed his nightstick, my girlfriend went behind him. She was a strong Southern guy. I wanted him to feel the same pain I felt. And I kept on saying to him, how do you like the pain? Do you like it? Do you like it? I kept on hitting him and hitting him. At that particular minute, I wanted to kill him.
I wanted to do every destructive thing that I could think of at that time to hurt anyone that had hurt us through the years.
It's like just when you see a man protecting his own life. They weren't the queens that people call them. They were men fighting for their lives. And I fight alongside them any day, no matter how old I was.
But a lot of heads were bashed. But it didn't hurt their true feelings. They all came back from there. And nothing. That's when you could tell that nothing could stop us at that time, but any time in the future.
So there's obviously like a whole lot of different stories about the Stonewall riot and the night it happened, and lots of sort of contending who was the first person to throw the first stone or the first punch or the first high heel. It makes wearing high heels slightly appealing for the first time. It's like, oh, yeah. It would be a very satisfying thing. One of my favourite stories is the story of the butch lesbian in the who was arrested, thrown in the back of the car, a locked police car, and basically from the inside was rocking the car so much that the lock popped on the inside and she managed to get out and start fighting again. They did the same thing, because cops are stupid sometimes, put her back in the car, she did the same thing, rocking it, got out, got away, like, amazing, just all of these little stories. The time when the riot police arrived and people describe how, you know, like a typical riot squad, you know, with all of their armour and whatnot and extra long nightsticks, truncheons, batons or whatever you call them, and form this kind of Roman wedge, and it's still like they use these same tactics to approach the crowd to try to disperse people. And they, I guess, went into it thinking, well, what are this bunch of queens like? We'll just go in there and off they'll go and that'll be it. And although some of the young people said they ran, what they did was they just ran around the block. This was their neighbourhood. They ran around the block, came up behind the riot police and started getting them from behind. And the row of queens who just linked arms started doing the can-can and singing that song about pubic hair and whatever, like, it was just this, like, they just staggered the police, you know. They didn't know what to do about it. And the acts of solidarity that then started to come in the days that followed, like the black liberation kind of activists who came and joined in the riots, even people describe how on the hill up behind Christopher Street there was the women's prison. So there's a lot of lesbians, a lot of black and Hispanic women in that prison, the House of Detention, the House of D on the hill. And on the second night of the riots, you could see coming from the House of Detention, it was like sort of firework-y type. People were like, what's going on up there? And it was this beautiful sight of this kind of, like, stuff floating, glowing through the air. And what was happening is the women in the prison had got all of the toilet paper they could find, making it into chunks, lighting it on fire and throwing it out of the windows from all the floors of the prison. So it was just like this golden rain of solidarity coming down from the women's prison. And there's, like, 100 of those stories. You have to read all about them, but that's my favourite ones. Yeah.
Yeah, so the response wasn't all love. This is quite a... It would have been a great title if it was in a gay magazine, but this is like the absolute smug contempt from the mainstream media reporting on the riots. And also, there were elements of the more established gay rights movement that rejected the riots. This is a message written on the walls of the village the day after the initial riots by the Mattachine Society. And they were, you know, pleading with protesters to maintain the peace, but seen as the peace for gay people was intolerable oppression. The calls to refrain from the riots went unheard, and the protests and disturbances continued for 5 more days and nights. And being a part of any struggle brings with it a whole mixture of emotions, but with Stonewall in particular, the most overwhelming seems to be this sense of just freedom and celebration. For the first time, LGBTI people gathered together on the streets in the open air, no longer hiding behind trees, no longer hiding behind the windows, boarded up windows of gay bars. This was massive. And it wasn't just people standing up for their rights in the face of oppressive policing. They were absolutely revelling in it. One participant said, "It's a thing of wonder. It just hit me. This was our moment. Did I know what had happened at that point? No. But I knew that something fundamental happened that would change my life." And the gay poet Allen Ginsberg, he walked through the village the day after the first riots, surveying the damage, and said, "You know, the guys there, they look so beautiful. They lost that wounded look that they all had 10 years ago." And it was just, yeah, this release of fear, the celebration of personhood. Gay is okay. And not just that, gay is good. I just got so many nice quotes. That night the police ran from us, the lowliest of lows. It was fantastic. And so during the months and weeks weeks and months that followed that, activists in New York, but also in other countries, Canada, France, Britain, Germany, Belgium, Australia, just to name a few, within 2 years had built gay liberation front groups and gay rights groups. And Stonewall was the foundation of a new gay rights movement, one that wanted nothing short of liberation.
Yeah, and there's a sort of strange alchemy about some of these things. Like, I was talking to a guy who's a historian. He's, like, one of the people from the Lesbian and Gay Archives in Melbourne. He was describing, when he looks back at the history of the period, that people in Melbourne knew more about Stonewall than they did about what was happening in Sydney with gay liberation. Like, for some reason, it just became this thing because it was such an epic story that it just spread, like, we're about to do something, we can do it, and gave people this confidence. At the same time, the people in New York, you know, the political activists like us in different groups and whatnot, go, okay, wow, we didn't realise that was about to happen. Like, we didn't think that was going to be as big as it was, you know, attracting hundreds of thousands of people. We didn't realise it was going to go on for so long. What the hell do we do next? And that's the question we all have to face at some point. What is the next thing we're going to do? And what do? You have a meeting about it to discuss what you're going to do next. And this happened after Stonewall. There was a meeting in a hot room in the back of a pub where somebody brought like a six-pack of cold beer and they sat down and they said, what should we do about it? Let's call another meeting. Great idea. So they had another meeting in which 200 or so people came, mostly men, and this lesbian activist, Martha Shelley, was saying to the person next to her, I think we should probably have a march. Like, that's what we should do next. And the person next to her said, you should stand up and raise this to the whole meeting, get people to vote on it. So she's like, okay, I will. She puts her hand up and she says, I think we should march to commemorate Stonewall 1 month after the night and have it around here and we'll organise it. She said, I was so nervous, I didn't know if people were going to agree or not. They put it to a vote. Every single person in the room put their hand up and said, yeah, we'll come with you, we'll march. And that's the first Pride march, basically. And then they said, well, we need an organising group, I guess, to do this. Like, we need to have a meeting about that. And so they got together and they were like, let's throw around some names, some options, what should we call it? And somebody, and it's disputed who came up with it, but somebody suggested, why don't we call ourselves the Gay Liberation Front? And Martha Shelley said, I remember slamming the table and saying, that's it. We're the Gay Liberation Front. It was tying together all the radical politics that were part of me with my gayness, the whole thing coalescing into one unifying ideology. And that is how the Gay Liberation Front came into being.
Yeah, and this was a group that took the question of fighting for gay rights, but took that to fighting for gay liberation, and not just gay liberation, but for liberation full stop. This is just an excerpt from their manifesto from London in 71. And then at one of their early rallies, one of their first as the Gay Liberation Front, called a lot of rallies, a lot of demonstrations, a lot of meetings to organise them as well.
I just stuck there because that's my favourite. Placards?
This was 2 years after the first Pride and after, the first Stonewall riots. And so this was, again, just like every year was a commemoration of the movement. And this one was in Sydney or somewhere in Australia, I think Sydney. Things were happening here as well.
Yeah, and the Sparks were it. Doing something right. So fast forward, full colour, to 2017 and the years before it, and tears in your eyes. Here we were, the biggest mobilisations in the history of Australian gay liberation around the question of marriage equality. Who would have thought it when we were on the steps reigning in Parliament all those years ago? But there we were, and we employed the same strategies and tactics as the GLF in many ways. How do you get people involved? How do you mobilise them? How do you take these questions democratically to the street and fight it out? And that's what we did with the marriage equality campaign. This was the great moment when the Jesus Christ Superstar train came to hire and I was talking with my Rosa Luxemburg t-shirt on the beach. Anyway, that's enough about me. And that's how we felt when we won that fucking vote. Oh my god, that was a great day. Anyway, in that very same month where we got overwhelming support for equal marriage, the government, the scumbag Liberal government said, I think we should have a commission into religious freedom. Oh, what a coincidence in that very same month that they started investigating whether the Christians were persecuted in Australia or not. So these scumbags have crawled back out of the sewers to organise again.
That's just so you don't have to look at them.
So you got the biggest laugh.
It's a good sign.
Yeah. So we're just gonna finish just saying something real quick about this religious stuff, and then we'll finish.
Yeah, because I think we need to be really clear that this push for religious exemptions and the religious discrimination bill that's being discussed is in no way about defending against discrimination. It's about enshrining homophobia and transphobia further into law, and about ensuring the right of Christian bigots to discriminate against us. And so this renewed push from bigots against the onslaught of pro-LGBTI sentiment that exists in Australian society is backed by religious fanatics like the Australian Christian Lobby, but also the ALP, who moved to dump any mention of LGBTI people from their party platform. And so when we're in the situation where powerful homophobic lobby groups and politicians have jumped on ScoMo's re-election to continue to sulk and demand a consultation prize in the wake of our victory in the marriage equality campaign. And our response to that needs to be, you get absolutely nothing. There's a lot to say about the bigotry of the potential discrimination bill, including something ScoMo's trying to move. He already tried it in 2017, but it didn't get through, which is an amendment to the Marriage Act asserting that a man and a woman united in marriage with their children is a fundamental building block of human society. It's absolute filth, but I think it makes things pretty crystal clear. And I also think it makes it pretty crystal clear that we can't take any of our victories for granted until we actually unearth this rotten system that continues to rely on division and inequalities. It will continue to squeeze us and come up with new ways to oppress us and put us back in our box. And so the fight for LGBTI rights has meant that many of us no longer exist in the same hideous conditions as what we described at the start of the talk, but as the world becomes an increasingly hostile place for all different oppressed people, the fight against LGBTI oppression and oppression as a whole, as well as the system as a whole, is all the more urgent.
Yeah, so just to finish on those three things, just to remind you what they were from the beginning, this idea of continuity and change, the idea that what we do as activists and the politics that we argue really does matter, and it can be those pivotal moments that you don't realise are pivotal until afterwards, and then everyone says they wanted to be there or they were there, you know. Well, you should be there, all of you in this room, at every single one of them. And that we need a system change, really, like we do to fight climate change, like we do for liberation around racism, like we do every other single question, including the exploitation of all of us who work, that we need fundamental change to the whole structures of society.
And we can't equivocate, as some of the more moderate drags on the LGBTI movement have done historically and today, begging for a seat at the table for crumbs and how we can best bend over backwards to suit this system. But why would we limit ourselves to begging for crumbs when actually when we fight we can win so much more than that? To go back to Martha Shelley, at the first march, the month after Stonewall, she got up in a speech to the crowd and she argued the time has come for us to walk in the sunshine and we don't have to ask permission to do it. Stonewall, it was a turning point for LGBTI people, for human history. And I think what we can learn is we need a movement today that once again poses the question of liberation, not only for LGBTI people, but for humanity as a whole. And Stonewall was a riot, but we need a revolution.
And sorry to those who didn't get called. There was nearly 100 people in the room, and it was great that so many of you wanted to speak. But there's plenty of time to speak to each other in the break about what some of the things that come up. So without further ado, here's Caitlin and Roz to finish you off.
Yeah, I thought that was... Sorry. I thought that was a really great discussion. And I wanted to talk
people are so rude.
I wanted to talk about Huey P. Newton as well and the Solidarity, but that has been pulled from out under my feet. I think that, yeah, just one thing. I think in response to the first question, I think it's one thing to see the official channels and the halls of power and going into them to try and advance our rights. I think that's one thing, and it's another to take on those same halls of power and fight them to win our demands. And I think that that's what the marriage equality campaign really was from the get-go. And, yeah, politicians might have at the end jumped on board when they realised what side history was on, because they saw, you know, the tens of thousands of people march across, hundreds of thousands of people march across the country. And our response to them jumping on board, I think, just be like, good, but you don't get any praise for it. Like, yeah, I remember just, I was at the celebration march that happened the day we won, and I was handing out leaflets for the next refugee rally, and Christine Foster, who's Tony Abbott's sister, she'd given a speech. It was like really shit. Everyone, like, you know, she got down and I was handing out leaflets. I didn't see who it was. I tried to give her one. She, like, smugly rejected it. I realised who she was. Would have said something like liberal scum or whatever. And she turns around and says, "How dare you? You don't belong here. This is my night." And it was just something like, this is the contempt that the ruling class and the people who want to jump on board our campaign right at the last minute, who can sit in the Liberal Party, you know, watch their brother be one of the most, you know, famous bigots in the country and be fine with it. And I think that, yeah, we've got to have the politics of, like, you know, celebrating our wins, but, yeah, pushing for more radical politics. It doesn't just say, oh, yeah, our movement stops with Christine Foster. It's, you know, got to go way further than that. And I think in terms of also sort of, like, seeing marriage equality as not, you know, a radical demand that was going to, you know, take on capitalism, but actually often movements like, you know, the gay rights movement start with low horizons because people don't actually expect much from the society. Like, the world is so shit that, like, yeah, people's horizons on so many questions are so low. But when actually you engage with the fight and the struggle, that's where people start to have their expectations raised, start to expect more from society and demand more from society. And I think it's the job of people like us in this room, in the movement, to actually be pushing on that and pushing it to go as far as it possibly can. And that task is very urgent. You know, you've got Bolsonaro. People have spoken about him at the conference, the far-right president in Brazil. You know, he said he'd rather his son be hit by a car than be gay. The Trump administration, I could go on forever about just the, you know, atrocities facing our side. But that makes it more, all the more urgent to actually join the fight back.
Don't put a teacher and a whiteboard pen and a whiteboard together.
We used to do this thing in safe schools that was about connecting these ideas of sex, gender and sexuality. And it involves, and you do the wedding cake like this. And we used to say, and then that's the thing. And it would explain these three different tiers and how they're separate to each other but very much interconnected. And one of the things we say LGBTI, we don't often talk about the I part, but people should know that forced corrective surgeries go on to babies who are born right with an intersex variation. And in the medical and political, like the combined medical political justification, which is all written down for why these surgeries take place, they say one of the reasons are a set of psychosocial factors. So how your sort of psychology will be affected by the social stigma associated with the way your body is. And they say one of these psychosocial factors is your future inability to get married if you don't have corrective surgery to your body. So the presumption of your body has to fit, it has to fit with your gender, and then your gender is automatically going to be attracted to the opposite gender. Like, all of that flows through this heteronormativity that dominates capitalist society. And that heteronormativity is absolutely interconnected with women's oppression and the kind of domination of white supremacy. Like, all of these things are absolutely connected together. And when we fight back against them, some people will fight back for all sorts of different reasons. There will be people in the Stonewall riot who just wanted to get back in there and have another drink. Like, who would just say, like, oh, what the
fuck, why can't we get in there? Oh, fuck you. Like, radical, convinced socialists, they don't know, they don't want to smash the state, they just want to get to the bar. But, like, these things, like, there's always a lot going on as activists. But socialists have, in fact, the most fierce critique of the state out of anyone with any set of politics. Like, Marxists have the most... overarching critique of the state that you could imagine. We'd say smash the state, actually. And we don't think you can just tell people that and they just think, oh yeah, okay, cool, smash the state. We think that struggle helps to educate people in the coming to the conclusion that you need to smash the state. And you do that through practice, you do that through being involved in politics, you do that by actually seeing the police do what they do, hearing what politicians say that they say, seeing what all the other political institutions in society say and do, like the Labour Party, like the Greens even, you know, like, and you come to your conclusions by being engaged in politics. And you also learn what solidarity feels like. Oh my God, we've all who've been to protests have had that sense, like, you turn around and you can't see the end of the crowd and you think, who are all these people? But fucking hell, this is amazing. Like, and that's something I think that when it feels hard, it keeps you going. And we actually want people to have a taste of winning. We want to win some stuff because that's the thing as well that gets you forward. Like, that's the thing that meant that sustained these gay activists and trans activists and all the queer people who fought in the 60s to keep going and still be part of the movement since Stonewall, since the 78ers, you know, here in Sydney and so on, who are still wanting to be involved because they fucking won something at Stonewall. And they didn't just win a demand to change some legislation. They won themselves a sense of the possibility to change the world. And I think we all want to be a part of that.